Now 6 o'clock, we will bring to order the Fluvanna County work session of the Fluvanna County Planning Commission for April 9, 2019. First order of business is the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. The next item is the planning director comments.
Mr. Chairman, the only comment I have at this time, I just want to make a save the date announcement possibly. We're attempting to put together a joint work session with the board supervisors around June 19th, the second board meeting at 4 o'clock. And I just wanted to, you don't have to let me know tonight, but just check your availability and just get back with me, and I'll touch back with you all. And it's primarily to deal with code enforcement issues and potential solutions, and update you on some of the steps we have taken and maybe what we need to take, and get the Planning Commission's input on that.
June 19th, my 54th wedding anniversary.
Really?
Wow.
Because that's my 37th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
Same day.
Wow.
We'll understand if you can't make it on the 19th then.
It's a Wednesday, and we can do another.
Excuses, fellas.
Okay. The next item is public comments, limited to 3 minutes per speaker. Anyone wishing to come forward, speak on anything pertaining to the Planning Commission, please come forward, state your name and address. Seeing no one coming forward, we'll end the public comment section and go right to the work session. Rural cluster subdivisions, Mr. Robinson will be bringing.
So we wanted to bring a topic for you tonight regarding rural cluster subdivisions in the county. If you go to the next slide. Some of you may have seen that last week there was an article in the Fluvanna Review about our most recently approved cluster development. I would note that the photograph on that article is incorrect. That is actually another site that was timbered. That's not the site of the proposed cluster. But as you can see, as the headline indicates, there are a number of people upset about Ivan Hill, as you may remember seeing in recent months. So if you go to the next slide. So just to recap, Island Hill and how we got from then to now. The department received the application on December 3rd and went to the TRC on December 13th. You all first took a look at it on January the 8th, and at that meeting you chose to defer it by a vote of 5-0 due to some concerns. It came back to you in February, and after some additional discussion, you voted to approve it by a vote of 5-0. But some of the adjoining property owners still had a lot of concerns, and there was still a lot of discussion amongst the community. So the planning department was asked to brief the board of supervisors about this project, so we did that on March the 20th. There were a number of speakers and residents at that meeting that came and spoke during the public comment period about Island Hill and their concerns. And the two neighborhoods in question on their own organized a community meeting, which took place at the library on March the 25th. Staff wasn't a part of that, but I do believe Mrs. Eager was present at that meeting. And there were a number of concerns that were discussed that night. And then the Board of Supervisors had some additional discussion at their meeting last week on April 3rd about rural cluster subdivisions. So based on all of the discussion that took place and a lot of the concerns that came out of Island Hill, staff just wanted to bring this back to you tonight just discuss it and take a look at our regulations to see which direction we may need to go. So on Island Hill, just to recap, that's where Island Hill is located, basically in between Riverside and Broken Island. You can see its proximity to Lake Monticello, right directly to the north. Next slide. And this was the sketch plan that you should recall seeing and approving on February 12th. So on that sketch plan, there were 49 residential lots that were kind of condensed towards the front portion of the parcel, and then the remainder is proposed to be open space as it approaches the Ravenna. Next slide. So just a short summary of some of the regulations in the zoning ordinance about clusters. We permit them by right in the A1 district. And I will mention that Island Hill, the property was zoned A1, which is the agricultural general district. So it was a use permitted by right in the A1 district. We also permitted by right in R1, R2, and R4. So basically all of our residential districts in our agricultural district. Our open space requirement within each district in A1, we require a minimum of 75%. In R1, R2, and R4, we require a minimum of 50% be put into open space. And then R3 is not a rural cluster per se, but there is a requirement of the R3 district that there be a minimum of 25% open space. So that's why I missed that on the screen.
That's always required.
In R3, yes. R3 is basically a PUD. It's a residential plan community district. And you're correct, anytime someone proposes an R3 district, they have to provide a minimum of 25% open space, along with all of the other requirements. So that's the open space breakdown, and then the density breakdown. Basically, you can see it builds up as you go from A1 to R4. So in A1, it's the way you calculate your density, it's one dwelling unit per 2 acres. 2 acres is the minimum in A1. In R1, it's one unit per 1 acre. In R2, it's 2 dwelling units per 1 acre. And then in R4, it's 2.9 dwelling units per 1 acre. Most of the county's cluster developments have taken place in the A1 zoning district. We only have, just from looking at our list, the majority of them are in A1. I believe there are maybe one or two that took place in R1, and we don't have any in the R4 district. Most of the county's R4 zoning is at Lake Monticello, and we don't have any cluster developments at Lake Monticello. From the comprehensive plan, just some language of what the county envisions for clusters. It you know, lists them as being small-scale areas surrounded by farmland, preservation zones, environmentally sensitive land. They should strive to maintain density similar to that of a neighborhood residential area, which this would maximize preserved land by clustering homes and small lots. Rural clusters concentrate development in a compact area and leaves the remaining land for preservation in common area. Rural clusters also provide an opportunity for preservation of open space, generally at the periphery surrounding developed area. So some of our goals and strategies from the comprehensive plan that have either been identified and are ongoing. The comprehensive plan does mention to examine the impacts of large lot development versus rural cluster development and amend the zoning and subdivision ordinances accordingly. That was a goal for 2016. I believe it's still ongoing. Next slide. And another goal is to Another strategy is to require a subdivision's open space be, as you'll see on the screen, item A, be located to further the rural character of the area, particularly related to views from public roads and developments. B, be designed for maximum connectivity to other open spaces in existing or potential adjacent developments. Also to act as buffers to agricultural activities. And then C, require subdivision's open space to be privately maintained and not be further developed as part of the project or without further public or legal discussion or formal action. That's an ongoing goal or strategy. So just wanted to show a couple of slides of what some of the counties cluster developments, how they turned out to be after development. In this presentation, I think I've only listed about maybe five or six clusters, but altogether, there's maybe around 14 or 15 total that have been approved since we adopted cluster regulations in 2004. And there are, out of that list, maybe two or three of them that never got recorded. So some of them got approved, but never got recorded. But these are ones on the screens that I'll go through. These are ones that were actually recorded. Cunningham Meadows, from what I understand, was one of the first ones we received.
Do you know how many acres that is?
I don't, but I know that the open space has about 58 acres. Slide. By the way, Cunningham Meadows is on Route 53, off of Route 53. This is Houchins Place, which is off of South Boston Road. This was another cluster. This was up until Island Hill. This was the most recent one the county approved.
This is the Habitat one, right?
Yes.
Yeah. There's only a couple houses in there at the moment.
Right? I think maybe 27 miles or something like that. So that was the last one the county had received up until and that's off of South Boston Road. Next slide. This is Needham Village. This is not an A1 cluster, but this is an R1 cluster. And in this particular cluster, the commons area, which is that largest parcel you see there with kind of the strange shape, that common area is privately owned. That owner did contact the planning department at some point within the last year. They were interested in trying to subdivide it, and they explained that because it was the common area, that was not permitted.
So it's not part of the homeowner association, but it still has all the deed restrictions that went with it.
That's correct.
Got it.
This is Sycamore Landing off of North Boston Road, another cluster. I don't know the acreage of the open space offhand, but you can see it's a good map. And then this is West River Meadows off Route 6. It's actually across from the proposed new cell tower site that was just before you as a special use permit last month, I believe. So those are just a handful. You can see that most of those on the screen, the way they developed those, a lot of the common area was around the lot, the residential lots, which is not the case with Island Hill. For whatever reason, but for the most part, most of our clusters that are on the ground were developed similar to what you see on the screen, and the common area surrounded the lots. So that's kind of all I have as a staff presentation. So as the questions say on the screen, this is opportunity to discuss if we need to take a look at our regulations. And
do you have a copy there of the state regulations?
I do.
15.2 2286.1.
You can take one and pass them.
Mr. Chair, we gotta ask a question.
Sure.
Besides the complaints that I remember of significance were some folks who just didn't want houses to be able to see houses from their backyard, which is not a real compelling argument for me, and increased traffic. What other arguments have we heard against this concept, this particular one?
I think Island Hill.
Yeah.
Another primary concern was the setback from the lots that are going to border those lots in Broken Island and even Riverside.
But that's part of the code. I mean, that's current. Okay.
But really, the Planning Commission really has no status in the actual approval. All we do is like the site plan and so forth like
so
that.
Something we can change.
Is that correct?
That
I think
like
the last paragraph of the state ordinance talks about it, that it's not, we are not allowed to have a special use permit or any hearings at all. It has to be done administratively. Is that correct? Actually, it says a proposal for clustering of single-family dwellings and the preservation of open space development complies with the locality's adopted standards, conditions, and criteria. Development and open space preservation will be permitted by right under the local subdivision ordinance. The information and approval of the cluster development open space preservation shall be done administratively by the locality staff and without a public hearing. No local order will require that special exception, special use, or conditional use permit be obtained for such development. However, any such orders may exempt developments of 2 acres or less properly located in the air installation compatible use zone from the provision of the subdivision. So it basically puts the burden on the planning department, the way I'm reading that, so forth like that. Also, I think it's 40% of A1 has to be allowed to do cluster subdivisions.
That was the code, I believe, requirement back in
2004?
Yeah, something like that.
It's not?
I think it's been amended.
Yeah.
Okay. I know that they just had to try to do it, a slight amendment, but had to do with certain types of lands, which was HB 2549 just in the legislature, and that failed. It was worded, it said, to do this amendment and reenact 15.22861, but I reckon that's the way you have to write it up when you do an amendment.
Well, I think one of the things we should look at is the setbacks, because in the regular A1, yeah, the setback is 75, I think.
And for the rear, yeah, 75.
Yes, rear setback is 75, and the rural cluster is 25. So it should probably, if we want to encourage that there's space or land around the lots, we're going to have to make sure that happens so that this doesn't happen again.
Mr. Chairman, can I make an observation? That's a subject of the year brought up, the planning at the Board of Supervisors meeting. The reason you're here is because the Board of Supervisors referred you this. So this is not something that Mr. Stewart, since he didn't watch the game last night because he went to Tech, et cetera, thinking of stuff like this. The Board of Supervisors instructed you to do this. There were a number of different issues that were brought up at the board about this general issue of the rural cluster. My suggestion was that you divide those into two types. One is what I would call refinements or tweaking. And this is Eager's suggestion about the setback is a good example of that. The other one is if you want to make major conceptual changes to this, be ready for a long, expensive project. Because those of you that were here when we adopted this know that was very involved. And I think Ms. Eager can tell you better than I can, maybe, but my sense was the board was saying let's walk before we run.
And it would be quicker too.
Sure.
To do some refinements rather than rewrite it right now. We don't want this to happen again.
Are we required to do it now?
No, they just wanted you to consider.
No, I'm talking about, are we required to allow cluster subdivisions?
I think you are.
The first part of the ordinance is the provisions of the section shall apply to any county city that has a population growth rate of 10% or more from the next to latest decimal census year.
That does apply to me.
Okay. Did that happen in the last census?
If they may not, but that's the next to last, so the last would have been 2010, and the next last would have been 1990.
2000, right.
Excuse me, 2000. Yeah. And you had plenty of birth rate in 2000.
Right.
So 2 years from now, this might change. That requirement.
You're right, it might. Yeah,
it will.
I'm
pretty sure.
But it may not, because the General Assembly might tweak this language. So, you know, they might go back and say, according to the 1990, or whatever.
One other question.
Let me make one other comment, and that is Mrs. Eager's comment is, I think, valuable. And there is at least one provision of the existing ordinance that embodies that principle. And that was one of, can you put the, go back up. This is one of the things that they changed. If you notice this lot here, notice it's much bigger than the others. And the reason is because it fronts on this public road. And the ordinance requires that any lot or cluster that fronts on an existing public road has to maintain the minimum dimensions of a conventional lot. So that's the kind of spatial thing that you're talking about.
That's why you had that 300 feet in the front. Is it 200 feet?
I think it's 300.
Yeah.
But that was sort of done.
Yeah.
Right.
They had what they had.
Yeah.
But what she's talking about really is if you take, you know, that lot, for example, I don't know whether you can see these lines or not, but that's the
the setback lines.
This is a setback. So conceivably you could put the house back here. What she's talking about is putting the setback line something like that. Now if you did that, what it would do is it would require restructuring a number of these lots, probably all of these, and probably at least several of these, to get a greater separation. I think it's desirable.
If we change this, they wouldn't have to redo that make it fit.
My suggestion would be anything like this that we change that's of substance ought to have a date associated with it. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, you don't have to argue about whether it's a non-conforming use. It'll be a conforming use, but it's subject to the old rules as of the date it was approved. You know, language.
Because we can in no way hold them to anything we set out today.
Well, assuming they can go forward with it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the reason I think it's significant is because anytime you have something that's this detailed and it depends on timing and relative dates and things like that, it's a whole lot easier if you don't have to go back and reconstruct and pull the cloth whether something is actually conforming or whether it's non-conforming. One of the other things that the board discussed, that Mrs. Eager's suggestion, was that you have a requirement for the open space to have basically surround the lots, so that you have, you know, let's say you had a 25-foot setback on these, but you got 50 feet of open space, then you've got your 75-foot setback, and you got a 50-foot open space. So you have the common area would look more like that. That's another example. Now, the point is, with this, and I said this to the board, and I'll say it to you, this developer comes in he is obligated to comply with the ordinance. He is not obligated to make what somebody might think was the optimal development.
Right.
So, and that's what he's done. I've talked to the developer. I was in that meeting, and there are reasons for the way they did it, and they're, you know, they're perfectly rational. You may not agree with them, but they're perfectly rational. What you're doing here is evaluating whether the rules ought to be changed to protect the people of the county, so that if this came in again, he couldn't say that. And I'm not attributing any bad faith or anything to the developer, because, you know, I understood what he was saying. It made perfect sense. Now, what you might end up doing if you did that, and I'm just making this up, but one thing that could happen is you could cut the number of lots. Another thing you could do is you could move everything down, because the problem with this particular subdivision is this, how narrow this is. You can't very well separate, you can't get this number of lots and separate them from the periphery of the property, because it just isn't big enough. Now, the problem with that is you don't want them all going down here, because number one, then you had more topographic problems, and number two, then you have this large unbroken area of open space is all of a sudden built up, and that really impedes the whole theory of the cluster.
Right.
So what you might well end up doing is having a subdivision that looks pretty much like this, but with fewer lots, and probably set back somewhat, so that maybe you got open space up here and on these sides, and it comes back to about there, and it's got, you're not making this up, but maybe it has 25 lots or 20 or whatever it might be. That's just an outline of what I think conceptually where you are for your discussion.
The other thing I was concerned about was the yield plan, and you said at the meeting that you felt it was correct.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got boxes in that area right on the cliffs. And there's also a setback from the river. It's supposed to be 100 feet from the river as a setback. So all of these are in what they consider steep slopes. I because it's so small, you can't tell.
And that's another issue is we don't have a prohibition on constructing on steep slopes. We have, well, how's the ordinance read, Brad? It's take into account.
Give special consideration to preservation.
But in the state ordinance, it says you can't do anything about that, doesn't it? It says for open space or conservation area establishments, cluster development localities shall not require in such areas identification of slopes, species of woodland or vegetation threatened or special concern or riparian zone, to require that to provide a property resource map showing such matters in any conservation areas. But also, what you were mentioning a while ago, this ordinance does allow to do exactly what you just said, because it says include any provision that determines appropriate to ensure quality development.
There's two other things that really impact this particular development. One is this peculiar location, because it's not unique, but it's very unusual in that it's directly between the highest density development in the county on one side, and on the other side, an existing large lot conventional subdivision. Now, I got to tell you, if Broken Island came in today, it would not be approvable. It could not be repeated. But that makes this in some sense, it's a transitional development. It's a development that goes from the area down here to the south, which is beginning to develop, but it's really still large parcels and open space. and goes up to this area, which is part of Lake Monticello, is clearly the most densely populated in the county. So having this in the middle conceptually makes sense because it's the it's a transition from the strictly rural to the, what you might call quasi-urban or suburban up here.
But I think those lots are smaller than what's in Lake Monticello. Right there in the cluster.
They may be.
So
there's 50 lots and they only use, what, 17 acres? How much was it that they used?
I don't remember.
20
acres,
21,
22 acres
for
the lots.
There's 49 lots. There's 50. 49.
It's 49.
Right. So when you think about like these options that have been presented, like the setbacks surrounding it with the open space, and you think about how have these folks been impacted in Broken Island differently than if this was just the standard yield plan, you know, they're totally by right, regular old large lot cluster division. You know, that 75-foot setback as opposed to the 25 is a pretty significant impact on these folks. In other words, if the houses had to be a 75-foot setback, that makes a lot more sense to me. So that seems like very common sense. And then, because somebody could come in and buy those, you know, buy those lots right behind the folks who have done the most complaining about being able to see too many houses, and have the same impact with a 75-foot, or maybe a lesser impact. So that makes sense. Surrounding the houses with the open space seems to have a big impact on all the environmental values you're trying to protect in any situation. In other words, so you're surrounding the houses, you're breaking up a bigger block of land, which has a lot of benefits of not being developed, as opposed to, you know, having that surrounded. It would be better to have, really, from an environmental standpoint, as much of the land clustered as you possibly can.
Switch back to the existing ones. This is the kind of thing I'm thinking of.
I am, and I agree. And I think if you had that open space that's behind the houses, this might not be the best example, but if you had it clustered with the other open space, that's just more open space in one big piece, which is always better. Always.
Right. Well, and give me another one, because this is just, you know, this is just a typical example. This is a better design from that standpoint.
It is, and that one, that lot is narrow enough that it probably doesn't matter one way or another. The open space.
No, it would make a difference.
I'm talking about environmentally. It doesn't make a huge difference. That doesn't, because that lot is not big enough to be significant anyway.
That's may or may not be true, and it depends on your outlook. But one of the things that this one, for example, does is if you're driving down 600, you can't see these houses.
Right.
And they can walk out their back door, and they have open space.
Right.
That they can enjoy.
They can go out and walk the dog.
Yeah.
Take them around here. And I'm a big, since I have lived with it, a big proponent of having, you know, if I'm this lot here, whatever, 247 or whatever it's called, and I walk out my side door and go here, I can walk all the way around the subdivision and come back and never get off the open space.
Yeah, I'm not saying we should preclude that. I'm saying we shouldn't require that, which you seemed to suggest earlier. I don't think that's a good provision to
change. Well,
maybe
not require it, but encourage it, certainly. Yeah. The difference would be, for example, let's say this were a Broken Island type subdivision. If you have this, I don't know how far that is, but
I understand the impact to the neighbors. I'm not sure that the neighbors would do that, because if I did my 75-foot setback, that's what they're kind of should be able to expect. and our cluster subdivision allows an exception to that, that it really is a significantly greater impact on those neighbors on Broken Island.
Well, what I was thinking of was maybe do it either way. And that is, you can't build any house or any structure within, well, let's just say 75 feet of the perimeter of the subdivision.
That's a great, that serves the same purpose.
You could either do it on the lot, or have 75 feet on the lot, or you could have, let's say, 50 feet on this side and 25 on.
So the lot could be, you still have a minimum setback of 25, but you got to be 75 foot from the line.
You got to be,
that makes a lot of sense.
The line would have to be, the external line to the lot line would have to be 50 feet. And then you got 25 for the internal.
Right.
Something like that would make sense.
It does. No, I agree.
Can I ask you one other question? It says in here the density calculation of the cluster development shall be based on the same criteria for the property as would otherwise be permitted by applicable land use ordinances. I will give you a scenario and ask.
That's the yield plan.
Huh?
That's what the yield plan's for.
Okay. I will give you a scenario and ask you what would be the effects of this. If I had 100 acres and I had 950 feet road frontage, normally in A1 you can do 2 acres on the road and you have to do 10 acres off the road, right? So if I want to develop that piece of property, but I want to put 3 houses across the front, which would take 900 feet. Now I could have a 50-foot road down. That left 94 acres of land there. I could only do 9 additional properties there, which came up to a total of 12.
No, you can't. You mean conventional development?
Yeah.
No, you can't do that.
Why?
Because you can't have a major subdivision in A1 that's not a cluster.
The only major subdivision that's permitted is a rural cluster.
Okay.
So how did this yield plan, what was the calculation for this yield plan then? What was the number?
50 lots.
I mean, no. Do the math for me. There's X number of acres, and there's 115 acres, and I'm allowed to have 1 house per
2 acres. But it has to be a buildable lot.
Why 2 acres?
Because that's
the reason he just said.
Because, but all those lots aren't on road frontage. All those lots they laid out aren't on road frontage.
On the yield plan?
Right, on the yield plan.
Yes, they are.
So you've got your roads.
Oh, okay. So they draw in roads.
So they're a hypothetical subdivision.
So they're private roads. Do they have to have the...
They're not private roads, they're public roads.
The roads in that subdivision is a public...
You can't do it.
So they still have to have...
Okay.
But these cluster lots don't have to have... 300 feet road frontage, and they don't have to have 200 feet like off for normal private road.
Right, there's a special provision for that.
Does the yield plan have 300 feet?
Yeah.
The yield plan is as if these were county roads that were built.
That yield plan is pretend that conventional large lot development were permitted in the A1 district. For major subdivisions, that is more than 6 lots. Pretend that that's the case. It's not, but pretend that it is. The developer brings you that subdivision plat, it would be approved. That's the determination you have to make.
If it was possible to build on that lot, there's, with the setbacks, it might be that you could fit a house on it because it's a intermittent stream, which is also has buffers to it, or the wetlands, has buffers as well.
That's absolutely true. The developer did that.
I don't think he did.
Well, here's a larger plan where they have the building sites.
That would be better to see.
We told him to. And we brought it back and satisfied the design.
I mean, and I'm not questioning y'all's competence, please, but you're satisfied he did it. Why are you satisfied he did it? I mean, what data did you use to make that determination?
I would say based on the ordinances, we couldn't get you unsatisfied.
I don't know what that means, Jason.
Look at some of them, and I'm not sure I'm going to get all of them, but let me give you some of the criteria we're talking about.
The one that's in the middle of our ephemeral stream.
No, that's a road.
That is an intermittent stream surrounded by steep slopes, which means that is almost certainly an ephemeral stream.
Oh, yeah, it is. But that is required to have a certain setback. If it in fact is an intermittent. What I would call an intermittent stream.
Says so right there.
But it stops. This is the outline. This is the setback from the intermittent. And he's saying at this point it stops being intermittent.
Right.
And which is probably true.
Now that's one example. Now if you notice down here, here's the river. And this dashed line here.
That's the setback.
That's the required setback from the river.
100 feet.
Right. Now you also got an approximation of the floodway. You can't build a house in the floodway. There's not much you can do in the floodway.
Right.
So they've shown that, and you can see that's approximately there.
Closer. Do you guys want to look at this?
One of the things that concerned me was the construction on the steep slopes. Now, I've been through this steep slope thing for 40 some years, and if you got a disinterested engineer in here to tell you about it. Not me, because I'm not an engineer. And not the developer's engineer, because he's got a dog in the fight. Get a disinterested engineer. What he's going to tell you is that it is possible, and I might even say practicable, to build on any slope.
Yes.
It's just a question of how much trouble you have to go to protect it from being damaged from the construction. And I remember this discussion from 40 years ago in Albemarle County when they first came up in Albemarle County. The number they picked was 15%. And 15% means 15 feet down to 100 feet side to side. Now, so people...
Our ordinance is 20.
It is. There are others that say 20, but 15, 20. There's pretty good consensus of engineers that I've talked to that say 15 or 20 is the area where you start needing to be particular about what you do.
Why did we decide on 75%?
That was Dr. Babbitt.
Huh?
We were at 50,
uh-huh.
And Dr. Babbitt said, no, it's got to be 75. It was just really arbitrary.
Well,
I'm just wondering because in the state ordinance it says you can increase the density or the amount of open space if you want to.
So we increased it to 75, which
right,
it's quite a bit.
Sounds like a great idea.
Well, what 75 does is it gives you relatively large unbroken spaces, and you can see, for example, if you're canoeing down this river, you can't see this subdivision.
In theory,
you can't see it from the river.
No.
Whether it's farmland or whether it's woodland, it in theory allows the landowner to, you know, practice something like farming or forestry and harvesting and things like that on the residual property.
And there are at least two that, in theory, again, have done that. One of them is the Saavedras. They've been dragged into it kicking and screaming, but they have. And the other one is the... It's the one on 53.
Cunningham Meadows.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It looked like they had pasture land at least out there.
Yes, that's right. Those are two that come to mind immediately.
And in this one, I mean, these folks could, with some difficulty in making all the neighbors that had to drive by, they could log that back there.
They could.
That's certainly allowable.
They could. And
you'd have to get 49 people to agree to that, which will never happen, so that's okay.
Well, forestry is a permitted use.
Rent.
It's still zoned A1.
Yeah.
So
they could. I meant the home. They could put a hog farm on that.
I know what you're talking about, but one of the things about it is that remember whatever our ordinance says, it does not necessarily outline the limits of what you can do. Maybe, and it outlines the limits of what we can require somebody to do or not do. The declaration, the covenants, can require more than that. For example, in my subdivision, one thing that's prohibited, of course, I have every intention of violating this at every possible opportunity, is no hunting on the open space. That's one thing that they can do. Hunting is permitted under the zoning ordinance. So, for example, let's assume you have this, and this is, what'd you say, 72 acres? Something like that?
I want to say more like 88.
Okay, let's call it 88. Could you go down here and run your rabbit dogs across here? The answer is yes, you could.
You could open a hog farm. Can you
come in?
Hog farm's a little different.
But it's an A1, right?
Yeah, but there are limitations on quote-unquote intensive agriculture.
I think I just looked at it today. If you have 750 hogs, it's considered intensive. You could have 10. I'd be a nuisance.
You could. And there again, if this the guy that owns this buys it and wants to run hogs on it, he had to smell it too. But if he did that, and there's nothing in the covenants that says he can't, and it otherwise complies with the ordinance, he can do it. Now, he's going to have a problem with his neighbors because they're going to be after him all the time about how bad it smells and everything else. Anybody that hasn't smelled a piggery can't understand what I'm talking about. But it's, a conventional piggery is a good deal worse than a sewage treatment.
Called a piggery.
That's a new word for it,
I believe.
It's a breed.
Probably illegal.
No, it's a breed.
Oh, okay.
Have we examined what other counties are, how their regulations are in comparison with ours? And I know most of us have to comply with the state regulations. And it still tells us it has to be done administratively, and we can't have SUPs on it and so forth like that.
We did it at the time this was adopted. And I don't remember in detail what it was.
Do you think that any of them have made changes because of what we're talking about now?
A few have. I came from Dinwiddie County, and we tweaked ours at least once in the 4 years I was there from 2007. But Dinwiddie also only allowed it in the minimum 40%. They didn't designate 100% of agriculturally zoned land eligible for rural clusters too. So
now, that's what I mean. That kind of change would be what I call a major conceptual change.
But if we don't allow, if we only allowed it in 50% of the A1, we would have to allow something in the other 50%.
Yeah. We have to do up to 40%, right?
Traditional?
Well,
which I don't think is a good trade-off. You know, what would we allow in the other 50%?
You have to allow reasonable use of the property, whatever that is under the circumstances.
Right. So we would have to allow some level of subdivision and development of some type.
Probably.
And from an impact statement, I mean, that's the whole concept of clusters. Clusters are going to have a less environmental footprint, hopefully, less gobbling up working lands in fastly, you know, developing places. So, well, seems to me going from 100% to anything less isn't moving us in the right direction.
If you look at that yield plan, that's a perfect example of what you're talking
right.
about.
Right. That would have to, likely, something similar to that would be allowed in the
Nobody's
other
50%. Running rabbit dogs on that property.
Or cutting trees or right. anything, farming or anything else.
Right.
So I guess my question with the where we are, we voted, we made a decision, we have community members that are upset, and unless I'm wrong, it's being portrayed as if we did something wrong. And so unless I missed something, are we saying we are going back on what we voted on, or are we saying for future reference after this, right?
You're doing the latter is what you're talking about doing.
Okay. So am I to understand that project will be moving forward, but anything outside of that is what we're addressing?
Right.
Okay.
We're just addressing if we want to potentially tweak the ordinance? Or as Mr. Payne stated, if we want to move into a direction of major policy shift and how?
I understand you can do anything from nothing, leave it to exactly the way it is, to not quite abolishing the whole regime, but making major changes to it. You could do either one. Now, let me repeat. If you make major conceptual changes, you should be prepared to devote probably 2 years to that project and substantial amount of cash outlay. Because I think you'd be needing to have consultants and lots of drawings and things like that.
From a staff perspective, we talked about this for the past several months. We have a 15-year baseline of projects now. What do we say, 14 or 15 clusters? We have information, you know, that what works and what potentially hasn't worked the past 15 years, and it's time to take a look at those orders and do those tweaks at the very least from our perspective. And that's what we're, at the very least, trying to accomplish.
Ms. Key, the thing is that we only approved a site plan. By right, they can do this. And it only comes administratively to the planning department. There's no SUPs required. We are not even allowed to have an SUP about that according to the state ordinance and so forth like that. And matter of fact, one of the reasons we deferred it was to change part of the site plan because there were some things that were wrong on the site plan to start with.
That's right. Now, one thing, let me go back and what I was looking at this yield plan things that I think are pretty obvious you can look at is if you see the crosshatched area like that, those are the steep slopes. In our case, 20%. Remember what 20% means. It means 20 vertical feet to 100 horizontal feet. So if you've got a 50-foot deep house, you could have a 10-foot grade differential between the front of the house and the back. And lots of houses do, because what you're talking about then is you come in on the first floor and you come out in the basement.
Yeah, I'm all too familiar with that situation.
Well, my father-in-law owned a house in Charleston, West Virginia, and his ground floor was in the front, and it was three stories down in the back. They did have a major problem, and his subdivision is a good example of what you have to worry about, because they actually had houses that failed because the slope was so steep. But those were substantially more than 20%. And it probably wouldn't happen today because the building code is better, and it's not West Virginia. Another thing I want to point out about this subdivision is this subdivision is unique among all the ones you saw, at least the rural ones, and that is this has public water and sewer. And that makes a dramatic difference in what they can do on the property, because I'm going to make an absolute statement, which is probably not absolutely accurate, but it's pretty close. You can't put a septic system on that.
No.
It's too steep. And you can't put a septic system on that because it's too close to the water course. So if you didn't have, if this property were required to have individuals sewage septic disposal, and, you know, well and septic, if they did that, there's no way in the world they could get this number of lots on it.
Okay.
But that's one of the major considerations. Another thing that we pointed out for special consideration was these areas of steep slope on the roads. And the question is, these are VDOT roads. Does that meet VDOT standards? And we posed that question to VDOT, and VDOT was satisfied with it. So
that's regardless how hinky it looks, the yield plan is legitimate. We don't have a lot of options. I mean, we made that decision. I don't think we had any option but to make that decision. But we're trying to look forward, saying, at least I am, trying to look forward, saying, how could this have, what reasonable changes can we make that will have less of an impact on the surrounding communities on the next island hill.
I think you've got the way forward in what you're thinking, and that is, you've heard me say this before, whether I get shot tonight or something, you're going to hear it again. And that is, when you're dealing with any kind of regulation, an ordinance or zoning ordinance or subdivision or whatever, the first question you should ask is there a problem? And if there is a problem, what is that problem? And then if I identify what the problem is, how do I solve it? Mm-hmm. So if, as Mr. Zimmer was saying, if you're worried about protecting the view from the neighbors, giving them a reasonable protection from the neighbors, then a setback is a good start, particularly a setback if it's undisturbed.
And that's a setback from a property line.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, if the neighbor chooses to put his property right on your property line, he can't expect you to be set back further because what he did on his property. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying to you is, don't approach this problem with the idea of, well, we're going to change this and do that with it. Approach it with, here's what I view as the problem. Is it a problem? How should we address it? And there's all kinds of ways you can do it.
Because I just want to make sure, and I hear our citizens and their desire for privacy and meeting all the code, but there has to be a fair balance of development and living. And what I mean by that is, before any of these clusters or any of these developments came to be, it was just land. Someone made a proposal, turned it into something that somebody wanted. And sometimes it just seems that people want what they want, and once they get that, no one else can have. And this project has, in some ways, and I don't live there, and would it directly impact me? No. But I think for me, it's about being reasonable in the request. Because you have business folks, you have homeowners, you have families, and you have a community. And so being able to be fair and balance all of those at the same time without being too extreme one way or the other, homeowner or business developer, just having that medium that makes sense and be fair, that as we... And I agree with a tweaking right now instead of a major overhaul. Just looking at that fundamentally on how we would move forward so that it's not one side is getting what they want versus another side. It's what's fair to the community as a whole. That's
important. Well, one thing I think might help you guide you on this is take these subdivisions the staff has picked and others if you want. And look at that plan, you know, whichever one you pick. Look at that plan and say, okay, I'm going to imagine that I'm the next door neighbor. Mm-hmm. What's good about this plan and what's bad about it? I mean, it's good that it keeps it off the steep slope so it's not going to erode and muddy up my pond next door. That's good. It's bad because it's so close to the line. I walk out on my back deck and I feel like I'm shaking hands with my neighbor. I think it would help you to look at these plans that have been approved and see what you think. Nagday, my subdivision, for example.
We're going to have to quickly wrap it up.
If I look out the windows of my house, I could see a house right next to me on both sides. But that's all. I can't see a house anywhere else. Now, they're there. But the design is such that I can't see it.
I think it would be helpful maybe if staff came back with some comparisons with what other counties have done and what changes they have made as well, mm-hmm. along with what we think could be potential tweaks to buffers and setbacks for next meeting.
And maybe to the pluses or minuses of those tweaks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, put it the other way. Identify problem, identify solution.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to have to end the work session at this time. We only got about, right now, it's actually time for us to start our regular meeting. So the work session has been adjourned, and we will go right into our regular meeting for April 9th, 2019 of the Fluvanna County Planning Commission. First item today is the Pledge of Allegiance and a moment of silence. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. The next item is the director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple items to report on board actions. We had one SUP approved, SUP 1901, the National Communications Towers was approved by the Board of Supervisors 5-0 on March 20th. And one BZA action report, BZA case 1901, a setback variance for Todd and Casey Robinson was approved by the BZA 5-0 on March 19th. That's all I have for this month.
Thank you. The next item is first of two public comment sections for the night. Anyone wishing to come forward to speak on any item that's before the Planning Commission or possibly come in before the Planning Commission may come forward to the lectern, and you will be limited to 3 minutes. State your name and address.
Yes, sir. May I just...
Okay, you can stay where you are.
Thank you.
I can stand up there for about 30 seconds.
You're fine where you are.
I'm mostly a retired, sorry,
name.
Phil Ianna.
Address?
589 Broken Island Road. Interestingly enough. 852 Broken Island
Road. Sorry, close enough.
I'm a mostly retired astronomer from UVA, and I've been involved with light pollution and similar sort of things, lighting ordinances and stuff, for decades. And I have been looking for a while at your outdoor light control thing, and I have some comments, if I may. There's some really good, strong things about it. You require in parking lots 2.5-foot candles and 10-foot candles under canopies. I was out the other night and I measured the Food Lion relighting thing, their parking lot there. They have 9-foot candles in the parking lot, not 2.5. And the Exxon canopy there has about 30-foot candles under it, not 10. So that doesn't conform with the ordinance. But the other comment is that the Illuminating Engineering Society has changed their recommended numbers. And one can easily find, justify 10-foot candles as being a legitimate number, as well as 30-foot candles under the canopy. And if you were interested in tweaking the ordinance, I think it would bring those things into conformance, actually. It's hard to get the IES numbers. I happen to have them. I was a member of IES for many years and on the committee that wrote some of these recommended practices. So happy to work with anybody on those. The other thing that's good about your lighting ordinance is that all fixtures, outdoor fixtures, are supposed to be full cutoff. It's much better than the Albemarle and the Charlottesville ordinances that don't go that far. Your ordinance also says light source visibility should be shielded from adjoining properties. I have a problem with some of your light fixtures. I don't know when they were installed, but I think they're not full cutoff. We were at the public library a few nights ago, and the lighting fixtures right outside are wonderful fixtures. They put the light on the ground, there's no glare. But in the parking lot there are things that one would call glare bombs. They're not shielded properly according to your ordinance. And I have other examples of that. As I said, I have the IES numbers, and I'd be happy to work with anybody if they're interested in tweaking your ordinance. It's not a high priority thing, but anyway, I'm happy to help.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to come forward? Seeing no one else coming forward, we will end our first of two public comment section. Next item on agenda is the minutes from the March 12, 2019 meeting. And I will mention I did notice one thing that needed to be changed, and you've changed that. Okay. Because I said low volume, and in the minutes it said low value. So, does anybody else have any comments or seeing anything that needs to be changed in the minutes? Or do I have a motion about the minutes?
I make a motion we approve the minutes with the specified change.
Okay. I have a motion from Mr. Zimmer. Do I have a second?
Second.
Have a second from Mr. Lagosino. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. Thank you. Tonight, there is no public hearings, no presentations, no site development plans, no subdivisions, and no unfinished business, but we do have some new business. We're going to talk about the Affordable Housing Summit.
This goes quick.
Good.
He's gonna break.
We put this item on the agenda at Ms. Mary Key's request. She's part of, but she's been appointed by the board as one of the affordable housing reps, planning commission reps to the TTPC. And there is an affordable housing summit on April 19th.
Yes. And I just wanted to mention to the commission that there was an invitation for us to participate in this process. It's regional, and the Thomas Jefferson Planning District, of course, is a part of that. We're this event that is on next Friday is for practical users. There will be a second event coming later for the public and how we're moving forward, but we're progressively moving forward with ideas on how the affordable housing affects particularly in the rural areas, and I'm just grateful to be a part of that process, because certainly when I first came to this board, it was something that was I was very much interested in, and I spoke to Ms. Eager about that, and I just feel like the individuals that are a part of this process are not only talking but going out and actively working with those individuals that are developers, those individuals that work with homeless individuals, and in different various aspects of the of housing and how it's going to impact us. And I think where the questions that I was asking about to Mr. Nichols, I think some of those will become fruition and how we're going to be addressing that from the planning district area and not having one locality be responsible for that by themselves.
So, speaking of Fluvial, what would you consider affordable housing in Fluvial?
Right now, numbers, we don't know what numbers would look like. But in terms of, for me, affordable housing is any body that wants to live here, there is something that meets code that anybody would be willing to live. If your circumstances was that you didn't have a lot of money, is this place that the county is saying that's inhabitable a place that people can live in?
And you talked about the different localities around and joint talking about this.
Yes, sir.
But I had a question, because affordable housing definition is affordable housing is housing deemed affordable for those with a medium household income as rated by the country, state, region, or municipality by the recognized housing affordability index. Now, in the medium income in Fluvial, last census was $68,223. The medium family income was $74,529. Now, we were, of all the counties and cities in the state, we were number 27. But Buckingham was 127. Charlottesville was 58. Goochland was 8. And the one that really surprised me was Louisa being number 38. And so looking at this, what price range housing in Fluvanna buying or renting would be reasonable is what I was trying to figure out.
So it would be improper for me to speak on that. I feel that this commission of folks is looking at those unmet, that unmet market, because those numbers sound great, but there are a lot of people that live here in Fluvanna that work in those other areas, and that's what this commission is trying to address, the unmet areas. So I don't want to speak out of turn by placing a number value when there's research being put in place, so that we can have accurate data.
What surprised me was the difference in, like, for instance, Fluvanna County and Charlottesville and so forth like that, is the medium income and so forth like that. And a lot of what we talk about in affordable housing is based on the medium income and so forth like that. And it's kind of hard to know what. I started looking at some things, and most houses, if you want to rent a house in Fluvanna County, $1,200 to $1,500 or something a month rent. If you go on the Zillow or something like that, you can look at different price ranges of houses. You can go to the cheapest, you can go so forth like that, and you put your own ranges and see what's available in Fluvanna County, or for instance, Palmyra or Scottsville or Remo Bluff or anything like that. And there are some affordable units, and some of them may take some work like that, so forth like that. But I was just trying to figure out what the idea is in Fluvanna, what is really affordable housing.
And typically, if you talk to financial experts, they say your total housing cost, the utilities, everything, should be 30% or less of your income.
Right.
And again, this particular group is looking at our rural areas as a whole, because there's a lot of pieces that fall into that, people being able to get to work. And what we've generally looked at in terms of the country's medium income, we're not addressing those areas that are unmet. So I honestly believe that if any of you can participate next Friday, it's an opportunity to gain some insight. There'll be some lunch and learns where the commission is planning on going to every locality and giving more information and really having an informal opportunity for people to ask questions, because we're trying to build what we need. There's a side of those that need it, and there's a side of those that are trying to make it happen and bridging all those pieces together. And so that we're not just constantly talking and talking and talking about it. This group is progressively moving to let's do what we can and be reasonable in what we're going to get done.
And where is this?
This is going to be at the Omni Hotel downtown. From downtown. Yes. 8 until 4.
Affordable housing is not just about how much it costs you. It's
exactly.
Access. It's how, you know, right. Can you get to your work from where you are, where you can afford? It's a much more complicated.
And you know, some of those median. Well, anytime you're dealing with an average number like that, and those median incomes for a place as big as Louisa or Fluvanna, I can't say that those are all that useful numbers. Like the Louisa number, whatever the Louisa number is, it's heavily skewed by the houses that are up on the lake, up on Lake Anna, where there's, you know, there might be some, there I know there are some $1 million houses up there, and then you got the rest of the county. And in Fluvanna, our number is skewed by 1/3 of the people live in a solidly middle to upper middle class community. You know, everybody at Lake Monticello is at or approaching that median income. But that's a lot of people in a relatively small area. Then you get to the rest of the county, the rural parts of the county, and you have a lot of 2/3 of the people That's not that many, but another third of them may be way outside, way below that median. So,
for example, if you get closer to Washington, D.C., Northern right. Virginia, yes, the sir. Medium income is much higher. What will skew that is Virginia is the sixth largest medium income in the United States out of the 50 states. But that's skewed.
But that's totally that's meaningless because you got there and you got Lee
exactly.
County.
Exactly. So,
and Halifax.
You know, what I was trying to figure out is what is considered affordable housing in Fluvanna County.
And that.
And how to accommodate that. The main thing we are interested in is how that can be accommodated in our county.
And that's why I think that this particular group, all of the localities included, have. I think they feel exactly the way you do, Mr. Chairman, but none of us on our own are equipped to handle it. So there's a goal to come together and make these agreements, these MOUs, to say we're using these resources and these resources are going to provide that. Because at the end of the day, it's about humane living, regardless of who you are. Everybody needs a place to stay. And so having these folks from neutral places, I didn't know anybody there, and they're all across whatever spectrum broad, and getting other folks who can actually input from, like I said, the builders, from Habitat to Humanities, our local board of supervisors, the different planning commissions, those folks already are in contact in parts and pieces, and we're just bringing it all to one central location to move forward.
Well, the main reason I said that what I did about Fluvanna County,
yes,
is Jefferson Planning District's thing normally are more interested in than other localities than they are Fluvanna. But I would like to know what is affordable housing in the county of Fluvanna, and for the people in Fluvanna, how we could come up with something that to look at it and see what we could do to make it better. I mean, that's going to be my number one concern.
And it's not just about folks who are working, young professionals or middle class people, mm-hmm, trying to find a place to live. It's also about our elderly. Mm-hmm. That's a big issue in a rural area, having an elderly population, yes, having availability of housing, the services that surround that to get them to fulfill their needs.
Of course, a lot of Fluvanna, basically, we are a bedroom community. I mean, most of the people that have jobs go to the Charlottesville, Alamo County area.
Yes, sir.
One of the things that I think Ms. Marquis is getting at, the presumptuousness to put it in words in your mouth, one of the virtues of this get-together is to give you the answer to some of your questions. Because I can't tell you what affordable housing is in Fluvanna County. I can tell you that based on my observations, which are not scientific, but were reasonably detailed at one time, our housing price levels are significantly lower than Albarl's and most of Charlottesville's. Charlottesville's different because it's an urban setting. A lot of very high and very low.
A lot of extremes, sure.
Louisa has a lot of very low, and so does Buckingham.
Yeah.
We're, let's say, lucky that our spectrum isn't quite as broad.
Right.
We
don't have the $5 million homes.
We don't have the $5 million homes. We don't have the roofless hovels either.
Except in Columbia.
Yeah, Columbia would be an exception.
But small number of people.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, and like I said, and like for Buckingham, the housing, the price of housing and so forth is a whole lot cheaper than it is in Fluvanna County even. And like I said, there's a big difference because we're ranked 27th, they're 127th and so forth like that. But another thing that goes into affordable housing is the amount of taxes insurance you pay on your property and so forth like that. And that changes with each of these areas also.
You want to see a good way to look, just unscientific way to educate yourself, just drive down the road, and particularly in Albemarle, but probably in Louisa too, to some extent in Flavanna, and look at the developer signs. Because what you see is, you know, Kumquat Acres, single family houses from the mid 250s. That'll give you, you know, that's by no means scientific or conclusive, but it gives you an idea of Kumquat Acres is a decent but not fancy neighborhood. It gives you an idea that if I had $250,000, I could probably get into Kumquat Acres. I couldn't get into Keswick. I couldn't get into Farmington.
The other thing that this having this group does is that if we had to go out and pay for a study as the county, it would be quite expensive. Folks would argue one thing over another. The group in itself is taking on tasks that, if, in my opinion, were handled by the localities themselves, we would still be 10 years out. And I made this statement to this board when I went. I don't plan to be part of something that's a continual conversation, that we're not doing anything. We have people in our local areas that are homeless. We need to have solutions that, while we're working on the bigger picture that's going to impact, as you said, talking about people's taxes and all that, those things will come, but we haven't built those places yet. In the meantime, what is going to fill those spaces so that everybody has a home? Because we're not just talking about adults, right? We're talking about kids that's still sleeping in cars. You know, we're talking about people that could have been us. And because it's not, sometimes folks look at it a different way. And so if we take all the elements out and say, if it were me, what would I want for myself? Then we have these groups of people, the elected bodies of folks that have come together. And as I said, I mean, these folks are from different spectrums. They've put this together. I suspect some feedback will be, well, why wasn't the community invited? And there has been advertisement for the community as a whole. But right now, this is a practical situation to give some of the answers to what you were talking about. A study has already been done. If you go to the, just so I can make sure I get the acronyms right, tjpdc.org, this week we started releasing some data from the actual surveys that had been done, surveys and assessments. So I would encourage, you know, each of you between now and then to go to the website and look at that, as well as come and spend some time there where you can talk to, you know, the other board members from the other localities and really start getting some ideas, because this team is going out to the community and going to get feedback. We're part of this. I think we're going to be doing live streaming as well.
We need to work on this a lot, but there's a lot of, you talk about homeless people, there's a lot of different reasons people are homeless. When I worked at Kmart, for instance, there was a lot of homeless people that lived in the woods behind Kmart. And I talked to them people as adults. Sometimes they'd come up and lay down on the sidewalk and do stuff like that. I could go out there and talk to them, and they would go back to where they were or something like that. Other members of management could go out and they'd be in a big argument. But I tried to talk to the people and get to know their circumstances. And I'll tell you that you find out that a lot of the circumstances that are people that are homeless are different than you would actually think. I had one guy that was probably one of the best excavators in the town. But he also had a elbow problem, a drinking problem. I had another one that one night it was going to be real cold, and I tried to talk this guy to go to a shelter, and he refused. He said, they won't let me drink. The bad part about it, that same night, one of the guys that I talk to all the time froze to death in a abandoned trailer down in that property. So you're looking at things and you don't realize what's going on, and you need to get out and talk to these people, because a lot of people are going to look at them and say, well, they're the dregs of society and so forth like that. Not always the case. One of them had been a professor at the university.
Well, that is the dregs of society.
Huh? Do what?
That is the dregs of society.
Fred.
Pass on that one. Right.
So, but just so you know, even in terms of those type of situations, not just having people surmise what the circumstances are, the folks that actually work with these individuals at the homeless shelter, at Salvation Army, whatever those places are, and their role and responsibility, they're going to present real numbers. You know, it's not, I saw 40 people on the street. This data is inclusive of real research that was paid for by taxpayer dollars to get some real answers so we can move forward. And I think you will find it interesting. If you're not able to make it, I hope to be able to share what comes of that, because I'll be there. I serve actually on two subcommittees for that actual housing committee to look at strategies and what we can do now while we're waiting on everything else to come to fruition. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, can I add one thing? So I actually have the report, the full report. It's a 137-page report, and it's broken out by Albemarle, City of Charlottesville, and it also has specific numbers for Fluvanna, Louisa, Nelson counties broken down. It's a very complex, complete report at 137 pages long. And I can send this to all the Planning Commission members, because one of the strategies that they're looking for is from the housing chapter, since it is very geared in towards each of the localities, they're hoping that some of the planning commissions will then maybe take some of this data and include it in their housing section of the comprehensive plan. So, but like I said, I've got the full report, so I can send that to all the planning commission members for them to review as well.
Eric, is this what the board voted on to?
So what the board voted on was to provide some funding for the event.
Okay.
And that was the $1,000 that the board provided funding for, a sponsorship for.
I thought that was what this is.
Yep.
And there's a $35 admission fee. Is that
there
correct?
Is a $35.
If anybody would like to attend, just get up with us and Valencia can get you registered.
Yeah.
Because I know funds were allocated for localities and how that was divvied up.
I think we have enough. One board member's covered, Eric, and one staff person. Is it?
I think. Well, I know there's. I think there's a few folks already going. I'm going. I think. Are you going?
I hadn't registered because I didn't know if we.
I'm registered to go, so.
I probably am going.
Can you send something out to the board members to clarify? If it's.
Oh, yeah, I can send it to all the
plans. Please do, yeah, because there should be, and at our...
It's very, I mean, it is like
very.
Very detailed, in-depth. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes down to, you know, based on different income levels for different areas.
And it does it for each county.
Yes, it does.
It breaks it down into different counties, and the data breaks out urban versus rural, mm-hmm. and, you know, gets into details of, apartments and affordable housing in each localities and what the numbers are. So yeah, I'll send that to all the planning commission.
It does. We worked on some graphics. Bless you. We worked on some graphics to try to break things down a little bit, but I wasn't sure if that made it in. I had not looked at it since Thursday. So, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, it'll be good to know that, and especially if the report has more detail than I just looked up, like the median income and what the definition of affordable housing and stuff like that was, to so I'd have some idea tonight when we... Anyway, going forward, the next item is the second of two public comment section. Any wishing coming forward about any item, please come forward, state your name and address. You will be limited to 3 minutes. Seeing no one coming forward, if there's no objection to staff, the attorney, or the commission, we will adjourn at this time at 7:30.
I know.